John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, July 1st, 2010. Hamas legislators are being forced out of Jerusalem, and Netanyahu invites Abbas to talks. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. The Israeli military and undercover forces have kidnapped Palestinian legislator Mahmoud Aboutir, claiming that he is no longer allowed to stay in Jerusalem. Aboutir would be the first of four legislators to face the deportation that Israelis have threatened. The Israelis' right to deport these lifelong residents of East Jerusalem has found faux legitimacy in the Israeli Supreme Court, allowing the kidnappings and deportations to occur. The four legislators, Mahmoud Aboutir, Ahmed Atun, Mohammed Tota, and Khaled Abu Arafah, have been targeted by Israel for their political connections to Hamas. They have had their Jerusalem identification cards revoked by occupation forces. The ID cards are given to residents of East Jerusalem by the State of Israel as a way to impose control on the eastern half of the city, which many Palestinians view as a future capital and a two-state solution. The legislators and their supporters have appealed to the Red Cross and presented a letter to the American consulate addressed to President Barack Obama. They are currently protesting in front of the Red Cross office in Jerusalem, and it is reported that they will escalate it to a hunger strike if the rulings against them aren't overturned. Dr. Jamal Zahalka, an Arab Knesset member, has been quoted as saying that Israel wants the Palestinians and their elected officials out of Jerusalem. This issue requires us all to act and to unite all our efforts, locally and internationally. Elsewhere, Netanyahu has said that he would like to initiate direct talks with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. He will discuss this next week with U.S. President Obama when they meet. Netanyahu added that direct negotiations were the only political way to end the conflict. Netanyahu's radical right political coalition, however, rejects any talks on Jerusalem and insists on the construction and expansion of Jewish settlements. Some local political analysts said that this invitation is another Israeli maneuver aimed at showing the United States and the international community that relations between Israel and the Palestinian Authority are normal and that international pressure to advance Middle East talks is unnecessary. In the West Bank village of Belin, a local nonviolent protester organizer, Yasser Meher Yassin, outfoxed the Israeli military, who invaded in an attempt to kidnap him. He has suffered from repeated harassment and kidnappings by Israeli forces. This follows suit with previous behavior of the military as they have attempted to end the nonviolent resistance against the annexation wall and illegal settlements. The Palestinian Prisoners Society has released a report documenting how over 100 residents of Hebron have been abducted by occupation forces. It also goes on to catalog the abuses of the Israeli military, including beatings, as well as the abduction of women, children, and individuals in constant need of medical care. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. You've been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center. For constant update, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Brian Ennis.
The one-year suspension of the Muslim Student Union at the University of California at Irvine has raised questions of double standards concerning student protests against public figures. The university sanctioned the Muslim group for planning and orchestrating the disruption of a speech by Israeli Ambassador Michael Oren at the Irvine campus in conservative Orange County, California. According to the Los Angeles Times, supporters of the Muslim group say the university succumbed to pressure from the local Jewish community, which was aware of the plan to disrupt the speech. Reem Salahi, an attorney for the Muslim group, noted students disrupted the speech of former Bush administration official John Yoo in 2005. Police escorted student hecklers outside, but no arrests were made. Yoo had written controversial memos justifying torture of terrorism suspects for the Bush administration. In addition, there have been major protests this year against university fee increases that led to the arrest of student activists and disciplinary reviews. However, no other student organization faces suspension due to protests. Administrators at UC Irvine say the Muslim Student Union case is different, claiming the student group actively planned in advance to disrupt the speech. The university had gathered evidence, including emails and the group's meeting minutes, and warned students against disrupting Ambassador Oren's speech.
Against a backdrop of growing international condemnation of Israel for its violent repression of both Palestinians and their supporters, most Israelis have rallied behind their government. The vast majority of Israelis supported both the invasion of Gaza 18 months ago and accepted their government's explanation of why 9 Turkish activists were killed by Israeli soldiers aboard the Gaza Freedom Flotilla on May 31st as they tried to break Israel's blockade of Gaza. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says his government is only trying to stop rockets from being fired from Hamas-controlled Gaza aimed at nearby Israeli towns. But Israeli control of the land, sea, and airspace around Gaza, as well as its 43-year occupation of the West Bank, have repeatedly been condemned by the United Nations as violations of international law. A small group of Israeli activists have launched a campaign called Boycott From Within, working in solidarity with the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS campaign, launched several years ago by a broad cross-section of Palestinian non-governmental organizations. It's a nonviolent campaign whose goal is to force Israel to withdraw from occupied Palestinian territories. Israeli activist Ofer Naiman is one of the leaders of the Boycott From Within campaign. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Naiman by phone in Jerusalem, where he talked about his group's efforts to raise awareness of the BDS campaign within Israel, how the campaign is perceived in the country, and what impact it's having.
There are Israelis, not just a few, who think that this is equivalent to treason. I disagree. I mean, first of all, it's a non-violent campaign. It's very important to emphasize this. On the left, people are less likely to call us traitors, but there are quite a few Israeli peace activists who have problems with this initiative because, in a sense, it means that you're giving up on Israeli society to some extent. But I do think that more and more Israeli peace activists are now coming to terms with this initiative and accepting it. More and more people on the left are supporting it, and I see it as something that will continue to happen because, when people see that it's the only alternative, that it's the only thing that can work, we'll have more and more support. Israel has been imposing much more strict measures of boycott and sanctions on the Palestinian population. I mean, ours is not a violent campaign. I mean, Israel's blockade is a violent campaign of sanctions. And another thing about BDS is that, you know, it gives a voice to people all over the world. I mean, someone living in the States can join this initiative and can be active. I think it's very important because many people all over the world, especially American citizens who are simply fed up with American policies, including Obama's policies in the Middle East, now they can do something. I mean, there's a global campaign and people can join this campaign.
You know, boycotting goods, especially those made by Israel in the occupied West Bank, isn't nearly as controversial as the academic sanctions part of your work. And you've said that it's not aimed at individual academics or, you know, at stopping publication of their work, but that it's more systemic. Can you give some examples? What do you mean by that?
Tel Aviv University, they have a center for strategic studies inside the university, and they have all kinds of academics and experts or so-called experts issuing policy papers. And some of these policy papers include recommendations to commit acts which, from our point of view here, are war crimes or oppressive or violations of human rights. Haifa's University, they have a special program for IDF officers, which makes it easier for IDF officers to obtain their academic degree. These are just a few examples of cooperation between Israeli universities and the Israeli military establishment.
Ofer Naiman, critics of BDS charge there should be more, not less, cultural cross-pollination in order to keep Israel from becoming more and more captive to the most right-wing ideologies. But the cultural boycott seems to be really taking off, with several international celebrities canceling concerts in Israel in the past few months. Your comments?
Yeah, I think we're seeing a snowball effect. I mean, because more and more artists are canceling, and then there's a picket line, and in that case, it's more difficult for other artists to cross that picket line. So recently, we've had some cancellations by Carlos Santana, by the Pixies, Devendra Banhart, Gil Scott-Heron would be another example, the guy who wrote the song "The Revolution Will Not Be Televised." So we're seeing more cancellations. Sometimes people are not very explicit about it. They just say that they have to cancel for security reasons. But, I mean, the real reasons are quite obvious. Some people have said explicit things about that. One should also mention Elvis Costello. He wrote a very nice message about it. He put it on his website. And right now, I mean, more and more artists are seeing what happens when artists do come to Israel. It's very likely that they will perform to a crowd waving Israeli flags. And that means that when they come to Israel, they take sides. So, I mean, there's a picket line, and someone crossing that line is making a statement. Obviously, many artists are reluctant to do that. I mean, they prefer to stay at home and refrain from performing in Israel.
Can you clarify the goals of the BDS campaign, including the work from inside Israel?
The campaign's focus is on the occupation, but at least the Palestinian call for academic and cultural sanctions, they're also talking about other important issues like the refugee problem and the treatment of Palestinians who are Israeli citizens. I mean, none of these calls is trying to impose a certain solution, you know, a one-state solution or a two-state solution, but it's just important to clarify that it's not only about the occupation. This campaign is a consequence of Israeli policies because, I mean, if Israel had accepted the Saudi initiative, which is not just a Saudi initiative, it's an initiative by the Arab League, a comprehensive peace initiative based on the two-state solution and the 67 borders, then there would be no BDS campaign.
That was Ofer Naiman of the Boycott From Within campaign. For more information, visit the group's website at boycottisrael.info.
NATO is reporting the death of an occupation soldier from a small arms fire attack in an undisclosed location in eastern Afghanistan on Wednesday, the 30th of June. Afghanistan, yesterday, Militants set off a car bomb and stormed the entrance to an airport in eastern Afghanistan in a failed attempt to enter the airfield used by Afghan and occupation forces, according to authorities. 8 insurgents died in the ensuing gun battle. The Taliban claimed responsibility for the attack. Using light weapons and rocket-propelled grenades, the militants battled occupation forces for 30 minutes on the outskirts of Jalalabad City, according to information provided by the media office at the airport. Iraq, yesterday. 5 people were killed Wednesday during clashes between unknown gunmen and cops in Iraq's western province of Anbar, a local police source reported. The battle began when a police officer and his wife went to a clinic in the city of Hit, 150 kilometers west of Baghdad. 4 gunmen suddenly opened fire, killing the officer and wounding his wife, according to China's Xinhua news agency. When the gunmen tried to flee the scene, a police patrol nearby exchanged fire with them, leaving one policeman dead and 2 others injured. Another police patrol chased the attackers and killed 3 of them, while the 4th attacker escaped, according to Xinhua's source. Roadside bombs are still hitting U.S. patrols in Iraq, despite all the talk of how the U.S. isn't supposed to be patrolling Iraqi cities anymore. Kirkuk, Iraq, yesterday. A roadside bomb hit a U.S. occupation patrol by the southwest of Kirkuk City, leaving no casualties. According to local security sources, the blast occurred near the Al-Nasir village, 45 kilometers south of Kirkuk. U.S. occupation forces cordoned off the blast's location immediately. Mosul, Iraq, Tuesday. 5 mortar shells hit a courthouse in western Mosul on Tuesday without causing casualties, according to a security source reporting to Aswat al-Iraq News Agency. Mr. Barack Obama, isn't 8 years of this in Afghanistan and 7 years in Iraq enough? Now's the time to cap the spewing gusher of blood. Bring all the troops home today.
And no amount of money you could give me, honey, couldn't pay me, ain't going back again. I ain't going back again. I ain't going back again. You won't see me back there again. No, you won't see me back there again.
Suppose Army recruiting ads had to have side effect warnings like drug advertisements on TV do.
The United States Army may not be right for every patient. Side effects can include distress, disillusionment, bitter resentment, isolation, traumatic and post-traumatic stress, sociopathic behavior, uncontrollable sobbing, uncontrollable violence, prosecutions for war crimes, prosecutions for domestic crimes, loss of contact with loved ones, loss of ability to love, brain injuries, blindness, depleted uranium poisoning, flashbacks, horror of death, horror of being away from death, loss of the use of limbs, loss of limbs, death, suicide, excruciating pain, the desire to feel excruciating pain, overwhelming rage and misery, loss of hearing, punishment by the Army for failure to obey illegal orders, punishment by courts of law or by enemy forces for obeying illegal orders, torture, humiliation, shame, dangerous habits of blind subservience, or the wasting of what could have been the best years of your life. If you experience any of these symptoms, deal with it, sucker. You already signed your name on the dotted line.
The conduct represented in the recently published article does not meet the standard that should be set by a commanding general. It undermines the civilian control of the military that is at the core of our democratic system.
When Afghan war commander General Stanley McChrystal was fired for insults hurled at civilian leaders quoted in a Rolling Stone article, President Obama made the point that he was terminating the man while retaining his counterinsurgency strategy. This shakeup in the Afghan war command comes as the number of U.S.-NATO soldiers killed in June was the highest seen since the start of the war in 2001. The Senate Armed Services Committee voted to approve General Petraeus as the president's choice to succeed General McChrystal as a U.S.-Afghan war commander, with the full Senate expected to quickly confirm him. During the Senate hearing, General Petraeus said he was considering reversing rules of engagement, restricting the use of heavier firepower that were originally implemented to reduce the number of Afghan civilian casualties. While the general said that President Obama's July 2011 deadline for the start of withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan was only the beginning of a process, there is increasing skepticism that U.S. troops would actually start coming home by next summer. Some in Congress are moving to tie future funding for the war with a firm withdrawal date. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with former CIA analyst Melvin Goodman, whose recent article is titled "The Pentagon's Threat to the Republic." Here, he expresses concern about the conflicts between America's military and civilian leadership seen in the McChrystal firing and the larger issue of maintaining civilian control of the Pentagon as the Afghan war continues in an uncertain direction.
Obama took the only action he could take. I can't imagine any other action than to fire McChrystal as the commander in Afghanistan. And today, McChrystal announced he was leaving the Army after 30-some years. But given the kind of challenge it represented and the total disdain that McChrystal and his staff had for the civilian leadership of the government, I think this was seen as a challenge to civilian control and leadership as it should have been seen. So I think the firing was correct. The only problem that I think Obama has now created is that in appointing Petraeus and moving Petraeus up to this incredibly high plateau, he has actually enhanced the political power of the military. And this could become an obstacle to the president's exercise of civilian control, I think, in the near term, because Petraeus now will have a great deal of credibility, influence, and power within the administration as someone who will be testifying to Congress on a regular basis. And what Obama has done in firing McChrystal is saying this is a problem with this particular individual. It's not a problem of policy. When really at the heart of all of this is the fact that there is no real policy. Counterinsurgency is not being practiced very effectively. And I can't think of one example in history when a counterinsurgency has been successful when the enemy, in this case the Taliban, enjoyed a sanctuary such as the Taliban does in Pakistan. And then when you look at counterinsurgency campaigns generally, they take on average 13 years, the few that have been successful. Now you could say, well, we've been in Afghanistan since 2001, so that's 9 years. But the fact of the matter is we've only been fighting this counterinsurgency warfare for two. And I don't think the American people have the stomach or should have the stomach for another 11 years of fighting against the Taliban. I think it was very interesting to hear Leon Panetta, the CIA director, on national television yesterday, quoting the figure of 50 to 100 as the number of Al-Qaeda members in Afghanistan. My own sources tell me that that's even an overstatement, that it's probably a figure that's under 50. So now we have 100,000 troops in Afghanistan looking for 50 Al-Qaeda agents. I mean, the policy is out of control. It's hard to explain or to rationalize. And I think the military, when you look at the Rolling Stone article, which I've read, is also out of control. And this is where you get to some of the culture issues that I wrote about based on my 18 years at the National War College and my 3 years in the U.S. Army.
Mel Goodman, there's some people who thought President Obama should not have fired McChrystal, dismissing some of what was said in the Rolling Stone article as just locker room talk and not to be taken seriously. But you do take it very seriously in terms of the kinds of comments made by General McChrystal about his superiors and civilian control that goes really to the heart of the U.S. Constitution in terms of who really is in charge of the U.S. military. You want to expand on that a bit?
Exactly. It goes back to what the Founding Fathers wanted for the United States, and it goes back to what is one of the most important tasks in political governance, which is to make sure that civilians retain control over the military. So when I picked up the New York Times and saw David Brooks, who minimized McChrystal's remarks as kvetching, and even Maureen Dowd referred to McChrystal and his smart aleck aides as engaging in towel-snapping jocularity, I realized these people don't even understand what's at stake here. The Washington Post's editorial board wanted to keep on McChrystal. I thought he shouldn't be fired, and they quoted Karzai, Afghan President Karzai, as calling McChrystal the best commander of the war, as if Karzai has become some kind of analyst of U.S. military leaders. So they have not taken this seriously, but this is the fundamental issue of civilian supremacy in military policy and decision-making. Now, Obama here has actually been part of the problem, not part of the solution. He has clearly shown signs of being intimidated by the military. In fact, McChrystal even said he thought that Obama was intimidated in his meeting with him that took place after his insubordination in London in October, when he was summoned to meet with the president and showed up in his combat fatigues. Well, anyone who's been around the military knows firsthand that that was an act of disrespect right on the face of it. But again, if you go back in the history of this country and why those people who left Europe didn't want to see another anarchic system and why they put so much power, particularly on war, in the hands of the Congress and not in the president, clearly made, though, the president, the commander in chief. And I think this is what's being threatened by a military class that has become a professional military class, almost like a Prussian military arrangement, going back to Richard Nixon's abolishing of the draft during Vietnam as a deal with middle-class families who would stop protesting the war once they knew their children wouldn't be drafted into this war. None of this is good for the country. The only thing that would be good for the country is if this led to a real debate on the war and the futility of the war. So it's time to get serious about this drain on our resources, our loss of life, our loss of influence around the world, the weakening of the American position internationally, the weakening of the American position at home because we can't afford to do the things we need to do because we have a $700 billion defense budget that will continue to grow and grow. And that budget now is sacrosanct as we look for cuts in all other areas of government. Somehow the defense budget has been given some special standing. So it's all quite alarming to me.
That was former CIA analyst Mel Goodman, who is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and adjunct professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. His latest book is titled Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@Hushmail.com. WSQTRadio@Hushmail.com. At the G20 protests in Toronto, Canada, peaceful protests were met with a sickening display of police brutality, raids on activists' homes, and intimidation as things began. Even heavy weapons, such as tear gas grenade launchers similar to a street sweeper shotgun, were brandished at protesters who up until that time had not used any force whatsoever. On the second day of the G20 protests, on Saturday the 26th of June, all this police violence blew up in their face as anti-capitalist protesters faded to the back of the march, disengaged the main march, and attacked their targets, the police, the banks, the wealthy downtown merchants who probably invited the G20 in the first place. To a great extent, this was a repeat of the September 2009 G20 in Pittsburgh, where the police focused on protecting the downtown summit at the expense of the rich businessmen who had invited the G20 in the first place. Sickened by police abuses, sickened by nights of terror, and police raids, militant anti-capitalists struck out with full force and fury and made these downtown businessmen and the police pay a price. The message to the banksters and upscale gentrifying businesses is obvious. Don't invite these summits to your city, because it's your ass that's gonna get kicked. See you in October, the meetings of the IMF and the World Bank.
Much like at many other summit meetings of heads of state of the world's wealthiest countries, tens of thousands of protesters took to the streets to express their opposition to the policies of the Group of Eight, or G8 and G20 nations, during their late June gatherings in Huntsville and Toronto, Canada. Activists from many nations marched and rallied on a number of issues, including rising unemployment, indigenous rights, global warming, and alleviating worldwide poverty. Canada spent nearly $1 billion on security and deployed 19,000 police for the summit meetings. While the vast majority of those demonstrating engaged in peaceful protest, a small faction of Black Bloc anarchists smashed windows of downtown storefronts and burned several police cars. The property destruction provoked a delayed, indiscriminate police crackdown where nearly 600 people were arrested, including bystanders and journalists, and raids were conducted on nearby college campuses. The Jubilee Network, one of the groups concerned about the discussions in Toronto, charged that there has been a lack of follow-through on pledges made by the G20 to alleviate poverty in the world's developing nations. Just before the summit began, the group released a critical report titled Making the Grade, the G20's Commitments to the World's Poorest. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Haley Hathaway, communications coordinator with the Jubilee USA Network, who discusses the failure of G20 leaders to effectively address global social justice issues.
I think that the large-scale protests really shows how deeply affected people around the world are by the economic crisis that is happening as we speak. And the G20 was meeting in Toronto. This is the group of the 20 countries with the greatest gross national products, meeting in Toronto to discuss what they were saying was the international economic system, how they're going to confront this global economic crisis. And what I think people were protesting is that they didn't feel that their voices were heard. We didn't feel that our voices were heard. You have a group of finance ministers meeting with little accountability and little true representation of what the economic crisis feels like on the ground. So that's why Jubilee is bringing the message of the G20's commitments to the world's poorest. We're trying to lift up the voices from the global south who don't have a seat at the table in the G20.
I know your group just issued a report titled Making the Grade, the G20's Commitment to the World's Poorest, which was quite critical of the course that these nations are on with regard to addressing the issues of global poverty. Tell us a bit about that report. What did you find?
We started off by analyzing both what the G20 had committed to when they met in April last year and what they have followed through since then and what they still need to do in order to really address the crisis felt by our brothers and sisters in the global south. And we actually gave them a D grade for breaking a lot of the promises. They started in April with a more or less solid commitment to both analyzing the impacts and taking responsibility for the impacts of the economic crisis, but also providing aid, reducing debt burdens for the low-income countries. And since then, there's been little progress. Right after the meeting last April, they gave a little bit of money and seemed like they were moving forward, but since their second meeting in September, really nothing has happened. So we were calling on them, hoping to have them use the moment this weekend when they were meeting to really be bold in following through on their commitments and then going farther.
From what we know now of what occurred at the Toronto G20 summit, was there any progress made? Was there any movement made on following through on commitments made earlier to help the world's poorest?
There were a few. The G20 reiterated their commitment to the Millennium Development Goals, which are the goals established in 2000 to have poverty by 2015. And we found, and a lot of groups have found, that that we're not very close in many ways to reaching these goals by 2015. So the G20 reasserted that this was something that they were interested in. At the same time, they didn't commit to more money or even mention the fact that last April they committed to $50 billion for the lowest income countries. They also established a development working group that would be looking at some of these issues and bringing it to their next meeting, which is in Seoul, Korea, in November. So we'll see what comes out of that. I think what we need to do is keep on pushing them to take action, to follow through on these very real and concrete commitments that they seem like they're trying to forget from last year.
Now, some of the other issues that Jubilee and other coalition members are concerned about have to do with global warming, the debt crisis, and reforming the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, which have long been targets of groups concerned about global inequality. Mm-hmm. What can you say has happened or not on those issues at the Toronto Summit?
Well, the G20 did talk about global warming. They made a kind of broad commitment to combating climate change. However, they talked about it in a way that would make one assume that these commitments that they're talking about are going to be non-binding and country-specific. So countries can decide what they want to do to combat climate change and don't have to do it if they don't want. So something that we see in our work is the devastating impact of climate change already on people in the poorest countries. Jubilee takes it from an interesting standpoint. This is where we really listen to our partners worldwide, where in terms of climate change, we ask the question of who owes whom. So a lot of countries are taking out new loans in order to combat climate change, and even though it's countries like the United States and industrialist countries that have made the most severe impact on the environment. So we reiterate this phrase, who owes whom, and saying, is it just that countries in Africa and in Asia, the small island countries, have to take on even more debt for a crisis they didn't cause?
That was Haley Hathaway, communications coordinator with the Jubilee USA Network. Visit their website at jubileeusa.org to download a copy of the group's Making the Grade G20 report.
Well, DNA is natural. It's the building block of life. And when the good Lord put it together, you know, I think he did it upright. He made lots of different organisms, a complex web of life. Each one depended on another, and so the circle it closed up tight. But then along came a man and a microscope, and he separated the genes. And when he put them all back together, he made lots of strange, unnatural things. And now food crops grow on the ocean floor, cows that grow on trees. Now the ranchers gaze while their oysters graze on grass that depends on a hormone spray in our genetically modified world.
On the 23rd of June, protesters against puppy killing Huntington Life Sciences were harassed by police outside the offices of Novartis, AstraZeneca, and Bayer. I guess they don't like Bayer and next-door neighbor Sanofi of Venice being called out for their past as part of IG Farben, makers of Cyclone B, as well as for their puppy-killing ways as customers of Huntington Life Sciences.
This is not public property, though.
Yes, this is
public. This is public property. Okay.
You hear me out. It's public property. With four people standing still. My whole point is walk, because when people come in, they're going to try to set your block. So walk.
What a pile of hooey. Not only does D.C. not have a sit-lie ordinance, D.C. doesn't have an ordinance that makes it illegal to stand still on a sidewalk. The cops have used this kind of stuff for years when they don't like protesters, but you cannot be arrested for standing still on a sidewalk. You have to actually block somebody before you're legally guilty of so-called incommoding, which sounds like stopping up a toilet to me.
Father,
Now, to me, like what the pharmaceutical lobbyists in these buildings really don't like is having their dirty laundry hung out to dry.
That's
something you really have to know. Jerry, you're about to run your corporation, and you are a protest these day and night. Sanofi, Aventis, Novartis, AstraZeneca, and Bayer, if you don't like the heat, get out of the kitchen. Dump Huntington Life Sciences. Because here in D.C. there's no sleep for the wicked. On the 19th of June, protesters showed up outside the BP gas station at 13th and N Streets in D.C., protesting BP's mammoth oil spill in the Gulf. This protest is not against any one franchise of BP. This protest is against BP's corporation. This station can easily pick up another franchise after BP goes bankrupt. But for BP to go bankrupt, people need to remember, don't buy gas at BP! We got people coming in to buy gas at BP, even while people are here to remind them not to. Everybody knows what's wrong in the Gulf of Mexico with BP's oil blowout, yet here we got selfish drivers buying gas from BP when there are plenty of other gas stations in town. There ain't that about right? The Grim Reaper set up at a BP station, symbolic of all the damage BP has done. While protesters were deploying the BP gas stations and oil workers desperately struggling to clean up BP's mess, guess where BP CEO Tony Haywood was reported to be going? Off to the yacht races, off Britain's Isle of Wight, to watch somebody else sail his yacht in a race. Out on the water to have a good time while other people were desperately trying to save the water in the Gulf of Mexico. Boycott British Petroleum. Boycott BP. Have you had enough of BP's British pollution? Do you find hot dogs and tar balls at the beach this summer a little unappetizing? Have you had enough of being run off the road by SUV drivers? There's something you can do about it. Tomorrow, the 2nd of July, DC's Critical Mass Bike Ride will depart from DuPont Circle at 6:30 p.m. Come on out to DuPont Circle, gathering at 6 p.m., departing at 6:30 p.m. for Critical Mass. Critical Mass is a mass public bicycle ride to the streets of D.C., reminding motorists that there are alternatives to things like beaches polluted. Critical Mass is open to all riders on any kind of bicycles, with or without helmets, driver's licenses, and definitely without BP.